All right. Hey, everybody. This is Brad Listy. This is the Other People Show. I'm in Los Angeles. How are you? Barrett Swanson is my guest today. He's got a new essay collection out on Counterpoint called Lost in Summerland. I had a nice time talking with Barrett. He is from Wisconsin, as am I, and we grew up in neighboring towns. Today's episode is brought to you by Northwestern University Press. Northwestern University Press has a new novel out called Under the Spell by Benjamin Hedin. Newly widowed Sandra is searching her husband's email when she discovers a correspondence between him and a woman named Ryan. Rather than simply sharing the news of the death, Sandra impersonates her husband as she writes back. This bold course of action will expose the secrets and solitude within her marriage, prompting her to reconsider everything she once held dear. That's Under the Spell by Benjamin Hedin, available now from Northwestern University Press. Listeners of this program receive a 20% discount on Under the Spell or any other title from Northwestern University Press. Just use the promo code PPL20. That's PPL20. The offer is available at nupress.northwestern.edu. That's nupress.northwestern.edu. Go get yourself a copy of Under the Spell by Benjamin Hedin, available now from Northwestern University Press. All right, so you ready for the main event? Let's get to Barrett Swanson, his new essay collection, Lost in Summerland. Is a mesmerizing, troubling, edifying journey into the heart of contemporary America. There are different ways to characterize it, but he covers a lot of ground and he does so very deftly. And I'm pleased to catch him at this moment in time, at this juncture in his young career. So without any further preamble, here is Barrett Swanson, and his new essay collection, one more time, is called Lost in Summerland.
Yeah, it kind of came to me later, in part because so many of the pieces deal with kind of zany or out there subcultures, right? I was dispatched by various magazines to go to one place or another. I'd be writing about personal experiences with kind of heterodox communities. In the case of spiritualism, with my brother who had, you know, was experiencing some psychic phenomena. So it was relatively late, I would say, in the process where I began to see what I take to be the most legible theme about narrative breakdown emerging. I began to see that, I think, pretty late. I think I had maybe 75% of the essays done. And then the last two, the one which is the title essay, Lost in Summerland, and then the one about Disaster City, those are the last two. And I really saw all of what I took to be the dormant themes kind of burbling to the surface, the ways in which personal narrative breakdown, a kind of distrust of narrative personally, and then almost a national distrust of narrative kind of colliding in those two pieces. Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. Narrative breakdown, because I was thinking about the book before we came online, and I was trying to come up with what I felt was like an overarching theme, or what I felt was like the core of it. And what I was thinking was alternate modes of living.
Yeah.
In post 9/11 America. That feels kind of like a fulcrum, you know, for you personally in your own personal narrative, and obviously for the country. But in so many of these essays, like you say, you're exploring alternative communities. And I can feel you, and I this resonates with me because this is of interest to me personally. But reaching and wrestling with this idea of like how else can we do this as humans, you know? Like it doesn't seem to be working. Like whatever we've been doing has led us to this point, and I don't think anybody's content to stay here. So how can we do this better?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. The book begins with an essay called "Notes from a Last Man," which was putatively a piece about going to Florida for a vacation. My wife's family, her grandfather lives in Florida, and he offered us the chance to go stay down there for a little while. And what it ends up being is a moment in which it coincided with a moment in my life in which I was almost fatally depressed, really had run up against certain cognitive habits or calisthenics of thought that were just not serving me anymore. And really it was born of, I had been tutored in graduate school in this kind of critical framework that's called the hermeneutics of suspicion, which is the impulse to treat any kind of text as an agent of manipulation or this kind of this relic of someone's bias or faulty thinking. And so when deploying the hermeneutics of suspicion, one is supposed to be rather merciless. It's a kind of unforgiving way of reading a text. And it became somewhat pathological in my case when I started to apply that lens to my personal life or to my own psyche. And you know, when you get to that point, when you're so susceptible of narrative and the ways in which people are constructing meaning in their lives, just sort of so prone to interrogate it, you really, I mean, it leads to pretty dark headspaces. And if the theme, I mean, I'm glad that you characterize it that way, because there is a sense in which I'm kind of, it occurred to me late that what all these essays are casting about for alternative ways to live, right? These other subcultures trying to make heads or tails of their lives by taking up certain narratives or taking up surrogate ideologies, be them techno-utopianism, be them spiritualism and new ageism, be them, you know, the sort of fictional narratives of Aaron Sorkin's The West Wing, right? Like I go to all these places and I'm really trying to make a cogent and fair effort at understanding how these people are coming at the task of meaning making. How are they finding solace in their lives?
Oh, that's interesting and kind of moving to hear you say that, because, you know, you write really eloquently about the difficult headspaces that you were in when you were depressed. And then to think of this collection as a way of like casting about trying to not just find different ways of living, but I think also find different reasons to live, which is tied very much to that pursuit. You know, it's like, you know, if the current mode isn't working out that well, there's a kind of touching resilience in going out and doing the hard work of trying to find other modes, you know, even if they lead you into crazy places where you're like, you're in Disaster City, like in disaster simulations, you know, under some, like, you know, what is it, like faux rubble, you know, like on your phone.
Oh, no. Very, very real rubble. I mean, it was truly a collapsed building. I mean, of course, they sort of create these little safe nooks and crannies into which they deposit their victim volunteers. But it certainly didn't feel fake at the time, I have to say.
Well, I really enjoyed it, and I feel like you have good instincts, like as a journalist and as somebody trying to survey the landscape. It's a really big task to take on, even if you did it piecemeal without really knowing what you were doing. It's like I think you have good instincts, and I enjoyed the ride. And I want to talk about a piece that probably made my skin crawl the most. I say this as a term of endearment, you know, like it's like, but it's the men's retreat. I recently talked to Melissa Phoebos, I think just last week, you know, by the time this goes live, and She writes this great essay in her book, Girlhood, about going to a cuddle party. And the effect that that essay and the essay about the men's retreat had on me were similar. Or I'm just like imagining myself, you know, you really bring the reader into this place, and I'm just physically uncomfortable while reading,
yeah.
Which says more about me probably than it does about the men's group or the essay. But that's an intense crucible to put yourself into. And I think you felt somewhat similar discomfort, but.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did. Sure. So I was dispatched by Harper's to go to a men's retreat hosted by this company called Everyman, which is one of the more fashionable organizations that have come up to help men redress toxic masculinity, get in touch with their emotions. And that retreat took place in Ohio, and it was a weekend long, basically a kind of festival of catharsis. We did a whole number of exercises ranging from the relatively banal, so like small group kind of conversations in which promiscuous self-disclosure was encouraged, to your kind of standard, I guess, what would one would associate with these men's groups if you're thinking historically, like thinking about the Iron Johns from the 1990s, or like something like those masculinist groups of the 1970s. So there were like anger ceremonies. We trotted out into the woods and were enjoined to scream at the highest decibels and kind of release our anger. And then we did something too called holotropic breath work, which was billed to me as a kind of pranayama breath work exercise, but was actually developed by a psychologist in the, I want to say it's the late 60s. It's been a minute since I've been in that material, by a psychologist named Stanislav Grof, who wanted to come up with a breath work routine that could mimic the effects of LSD. And
I should interrupt you here,
because yeah.
Stanislav Grof did a ton of, like, I think he's known for his work with LSD, and I think in particular LSD and dying. Like, that's like the core of his research.
Yeah, I mean, it felt like death while I was doing it, I have to say. We were kind of invited to come back to this main lodge on a Sunday morning at around 6 a.m. And after doing the morning calisthenics, we were invited to lay on the floor and try out this breath work. And after about 15 minutes of basically hyperventilating, the men started erupting with screams and sobbing. It sounded like hell in a very real way. I think I describe it in the piece as sounding like a tableau vivant of a Hieronymus Bosch painting, because it was just the most intense emotional release that I've been part of. And of course, when one does research on holotropic breathwork, one discovers that it's not advised to do it in an unsupervised capacity without professional therapist present, because vulnerable populations can have psychotic breaks or psychotic episodes. They're touching on profound trauma, and without proper reintegration of that trauma can be very dangerous. So rather than offering some sort of intellectual scaffolding for men to kind of think about masculinity, it was really kind of a buffet of catharsis. It was an emotional release. And one of the more saddening things about that experience was, in the wake of going to that retreat and talking to some of the other men who were there, they described not really knowing, not feeling, not being able to feel like how they did at the end of the weekend, and not really knowing how to reintegrate. That was the language of the men's retreat, reintegrate into their lives, and were finding themselves kind of having those same stresses, anxieties, angers resuscitated the minute they got home. So it was was a weird and deeply uncomfortable experience, I have to say.
Okay. Yeah, no, I'm now actually, believe it or not, I started, I think, before we started recording by confessing about how shitty my memory is. And yet I do remember a line from this essay at the end of the essay that brought it home for me. And I'm probably going to botch it somewhat, but you talk about how everybody basically leaves this retreat, which is a very concentrated and intense experience. And then it ends, and you have to go back to your life and your job and your family or whatever it is, and you're back into your own private grief. And like, I've been in situations like that, not exactly. I've never been on one of these retreats, but you go away, even on a trip, or you have some sort of reprieve from the stresses of your day to day, and it can feel like you've got it all by the tail, or like you've made great progress. And then you slide back into, your ordinary life, and it feels like all that progress just disintegrates.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, to a certain, I try to make a case in the piece that these men's retreats are not dissimilar from kind of the standard wellness or self-care options that so many of us are offered as a palliative for some of the emotional and intellectual deprivations of living under neoliberal capitalism, right? Instead of thinking about this as sort of the systemic problems that might be contributing to our anxiety and depression, we're often enjoined to just take up methods of self-care and, go on a silent retreat or go on a yoga retreat, something like that, instead of politicizing that anxiety and depression and seeing it as something maybe that's bound up with certain structural realities of living in this country. I think that was what I was trying to get at by the end of that piece.
Yeah, I mean, like the fact that for a long time, I have harbored a desire to go on a long meditation retreat just because I'm fascinated by it. I've never done it, partially because the logistics of my life don't accommodate it right now, like with family and kids and all that. It's a hard sell to my wife. Be like, "Bye, honey, I'm going to go away for 30 days. Just have some quiet time." But the other part of it, and this is, I think, what I was referring to when I said that my skin was crawling, is that the idea of being in a group setting as unpredictable and as emotionally loaded as one you might run into, A, at a men's group, B, at a yoga retreat, C, like it could be anything practically. I don't know, what does it say about me that like my fear of that has probably been as big of a contributor to my lack of having done one of these things, like.
I think you just have like a more highly evolved empathetic gland or something, because you wouldn't have that. You wouldn't have that fear unless you were worried that you would get enlisted into the groupthink, right? And it's yeah. I mean, my experience in a lot of these communities, and I think some of the pieces bear this out, is that you get emotionally entangled with some of these people. Like you see the desperation for this kind of surrogate ideology of this narrative of making heads or tails of their lives. And, there's a piece in the collection about going to Lilydale. And maybe we'll talk about this in greater detail at some point, but this is a spiritualist community. It's a town in upstate New York of 275 psychics and mediums that live in this gated community. And when I was there, this woman, very earnestly, I was like at a cocktail party at this like spiritualist art gallery where they had all these paintings on the wall that were putatively made under kind of trance channeling. So a ghost was an or a spirit was inhabiting the artist and helping them construct these murals or whatever. And this woman looked at me and she just said to me, I once saw a woman give birth to a spirit baby." And I just looked at her and blinked very slowly and kind of nodded very soberly and tried to think about like why does this person need that, right? Like there's what in their lives makes them susceptible to a narrative like that to make sense of what they've been through. And sure enough, she had had a pretty traumatic experience with her brother dying, and So yeah, I mean it's hard not to get it's when I think some of these communities are a little bit self-selecting, right? Like you don't go to these places unless you need them. And one way or another, I find myself implicated when I go. Like I see why I'm there. I don't end up writing the piece unless I can see that, right? If I can see the moment where I'm somehow implicated.
Well, the irony of this, the irony of my feelings about all of this stuff is that I have all of these reservations and all of this aversion, and at the same time, I am very likely to spout off about how I think we need to be more connected in real ways as people. We need more community. The idea of men getting together to talk about toxic masculinity and to take it apart and to try to find a different way forward. Who can argue with that? That is what we need. And yet, when people actually do it, I'm appalled.
Well, I think part of that too is I think part of that skepticism is born of the fact that it's not really unpacking those things in any kind of intellectual or meaningful conceptual way. There's no, there wasn't at least the retreat that I went to any sort of earnest or concerted discussion about some of the ways in which masculinity or sort of the cultural imperatives or the historical legacies of masculinity are actually affecting those men. And so because it's not doing that, is instead just doing anger ceremonies or something like that. But of course we would feel queasy about it, right? Yeah, I mean, but I hear you. I mean, it's hard to go to those spaces.
You have to make you make yourself vulnerable. It's emotion. It can be emotionally taxing. And like you say, if you have like an extra empathy gene, maybe it like kind of rakes you over the coals more than other people.
No, yeah, I come back from some of these reporting assignments just a husk of a person because they're so emotionally taxing.
But that's got to mean you're going to probably get a good piece out of it. I mean, if that's happened to you, then you've got something to write about at least.
Yeah, I mean, I think partly that, but I also think I'm just kind of like neurochemically a toddler, so I think there's some of that
Yeah, you and me both.
too. Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So, I think one of the things that comes to mind as I ponder the men's group essay and other essays in the book, you mentioned the Lilydale. I want to get to that, but just different modes of being and trying to be better in the world, more helpful, more like saner. It the thing that occurs to me is that there are no shortcuts, at least none that I've ever found. Like maybe there are some accelerants, maybe there are ways of having a concentrated experience that offers some kind of insight that can give you kind of a boost along the way. But it feels to me like, at least the way that I'm wired up, the only way that I'm going to ever make any kind of significant progress as a human being, like psychospiritually, I guess is what I'm talking about, is like slow and steady. In very slow increments over a long period of time. And like without getting hopefully too like precious about it, I think of meditation just because that's my thing and I've been doing it for a long time and like very slow and steady. Like it's just an exercise in daily failure basically. But one of the things that's always really rung true to me, and I think it's why it resonates with me is this idea that forgetfulness is the opposite of wakefulness or mindfulness. Like the idea that I forget everything. Like I forget what I read, like the wisdom that I goes into my head and I'm like, oh my God, but I'm all lit up by it. And then like a week later I don't have anything, barely, or at least nothing that's like easily graspable. But to dial it even like more narrowly, like I could be sitting
and kind of like awake or like calm and peaceful or whatever, you know, some approximation of that. And then the session finishes and like 15 minutes later, I'm like shouting at one of my kids in the kitchen or something. You know what I'm saying? Like, it just, it's so slippery. And like, it just, it's very humbling. It's very humbling is the, I guess, the point. It's very hard to like measure human progress or measure my own progress in a way.
Do you think that your spiritual growth is always bound up with, I mean, is it experiential? Is it intellectual? Is it these kinds of daily practices like meditation, or do you find other, like other experiences can jolt you forward as well, or no?
Yeah, no, I mean, like, I like an obvious one would be like a psychedelic experience. I think that could serve as an accelerant, at least to some degree, or like a some kind of cleansing thing, you know. But I think where I'm at right now, and it's always changing, it's always subject to change. But I think where I'm at right now is that I really understand the role of ritual and consistency in like at least my life. I understand the necessity of it because of this constant forgetting, you know, like even like enlightened, quote unquote, enlightened beings, like they're still practicing. It's not like they hit the mountaintop and they're done.
Right.
You know, there's just like this constant need to like reboot and recharge. And hopefully over time, you know, your benchmark or whatever for sanity gets higher up the chain.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I don't know. That's where I'm at. I'm just like, I rely on the ritual of it and like the day-to-day consistency of it. A, because I feel like it does in some small but measurable way help me. But B, because like I haven't found anything better at this point. Like if you got something, I'm all ears. You know?
No, I'm the last person to ask that. I'm sorry. Yeah, I mean, I put myself in a rubble pile to figure it out. I mean, I think the closest I just started trying transcendental meditation, and have been like you have slow and steady progress. It's kind of hiccupy, and I don't know whether I notice any appreciable difference in my overall mood or my general heart rate. Not really. I mean, I think, you know, a book launch generally is a somewhat anxiety inducing, but for me, I think, you know, what resonates for me about what you were saying about ritual is really the writing practice, right? Particularly, there's a kind of addictive element to it because you do the piece, and it's at the beginning, it's this glorious romance. And by the end of it, when it finally comes into the publication, you've read this thing so many times that it's all the jokes are dead to you. The language is dead to you. It comes out, it does its thing. And then you're kind of back at the beginning. And it's almost like there is a kind of forgetting that takes place of how arduous that was. And it can feel kind of pathological, at least to me, just because I find the whole thing so rattling as a person emotionally. It's like I forget how hard it was, and then I'm like, maybe I should do a piece about, I don't know, kill shelter. Like I'm trying to convince someone, a magazine, to let me do a piece about kill shelters, dog shelters that kill animals. And the people who come from no kill shelters to come rescue these dogs. But it's like, why would I want to go work in a kill shelter? Like, why do I want to do this? But that sort of ritualistic element or this kind of cyclical forgetting. But I do find that one obviously just does progress, like either intellectually or just artistically. I do find myself kind of moving forward or going deeper in each time. The extent to which that feels quote unquote spiritual to me is altogether different, or unclear, I guess. But I do think that there's a kind of emotional component too, right? Because by the end of this book, I mean, I started the book in a suicidal place. And by the end of the book, I was somewhere else. By the end of writing these pieces, I was somewhere else. So I do think I don't know. I mean, it's weird. It's maybe a little bit mysterious to me, but I do think there's a way by which there's a thinker named I don't even know if I'm pronouncing his name right. Emile Cioran, I think.
Chorin. Kind of, I think it's Chorin.
Is it Chorin?
Yeah.
Thank you. I mean, I'm just revealing my just like pyrotechnic ignorance about this writer, but I know a little bit. I've read a little bit of him, and he had this line like a book is a replacement for a suicide. I mean, he put it more pithily than I just did, but it's something like that. And post facto, like after the fact, looking back at this book, there's an extent to which I feel like, that makes me nervous that this is going to be seen as like a Tuesdays with Maury type book, you know what I'm saying? But there's a way in which I felt like whatever habits of mind that I had at the outset of the book that were leading me into the worst headspaces were kind of purged. I hope that the pieces don't read that way. Right. But it felt like urgent for me to kind of go into the sort of intellectual inconsistencies and paradoxes and of these various stories or these various ideologies that I saw kind of proliferating in the culture and that to which I felt myself susceptible. Like it was necessary for me to make heads or tails of those things before I could feel better emotionally. That's like a wildly unexpected answer to, I think, where we were just at. But
well, it makes sense though. I mean, it makes sense. It makes emotional sense. And I think too, it's like, I can feel you facing fears in a lot of these pieces, or at least facing mysteries, you know, like deep mm-hmm. mysteries that, you know, you take a long, hard look at, I don't know, claustrophobia, fear of death and a disaster, you know, in the Disaster City essay, yeah. You know, your brother, Andy, you know, in the collection is the centerpiece of two of the essays, if I'm getting it right. And to me, those essays are the heart of the collection. Like the, you know, your family and especially your relationship with your brother and all that happened to him are definitely at the heart of it. And there's a lot of fear there, you know, fear of loss of those we love, you know, fear of loss of relationship with those we're closest to or wanting those to be good, you know, like all that kind of family love stuff.
Yeah.
I should say, too, just because before it leaves me, is that when you were talking about finishing the collection or finishing a particularly grueling piece in the collection and kind of just being like, I don't know, rattled and done with it, and how then, you know, some time goes by and suddenly you're entertaining the notion of immersing yourself in a kill shelter. It reminds me of how like women often talk about how they forget childbirth.
Yeah.
Like you're kind of biologically geared to like have to shut things out. Otherwise you would never do it again.
right. Yeah. My sister-in-law said something similar to me once. Yeah.
So let's talk about your brother. Cause I think for listeners who haven't had a chance to read, it would probably be good to orient them. Why don't you talk first about like the incident, you know, at the heart of, I'm going to forget the name of the essay, but it's closer to the beginning of the collection.
Yeah.
You know, that led to your brother's injury and all the rest.
Yeah. So, that piece is called Okay Forever. And it's, it recounts, when my brother was 22 and I was 19, my brother was bouncing at a bar in Milwaukee and, threw a guy out of the bar, went outside to smoke a cigarette. The guy came back and sucker punched him and left him on the sidewalk. This is Christmas Eve. And left him on the sidewalk with 7 brain contusions. And he had a traumatic brain injury. His full recovery, he was in the ICU for quite a while, ended up having a 9-month long recovery. Thankfully he recovered and salvaged most of his memory and all his, sort of intellectual capacities. But he developed or purported to develop, psychic phenomenon. He would allege to have experienced supernatural things, hearing voices, receiving dispatches from the dead, all of which I regarded with kind of a chilly skepticism, right? Like, I'm a cold, hard materialist at heart. And, you know, when you're dealing with your older brother, like, it's hard for me to conjure Andy. Andy is, imagine Vince Vaughn, dispositionally, the actor Vince Vaughn, who works in like a tech company but alleges to talk with spirits. Like, this is my brother in a nutshell. He's like an incredibly charismatic person, walks into bars, makes friends instantly, just incredibly charismatic. And so when you grow up with this person in your house, and you're kind of, as the middle brother, I was kind of, I have a younger sister, and both of us kind of lived in Andy's shadow. Andy was doing vaudeville, you know, our entire childhood, and we were just kind of the sidekicks, you know, hanging in the wings, watching. And so when you live with that person, and that person thereupon has this grievous injury, and then purports to experience these things, you can't help but think he's putting you on, right? That this is kind of bullshit. And so for a long time, I did. And so the first piece in the book kind of recounts that experience, those weeks of right after his initial brain injury, and the second essay in the book deals with our trip to this place called Lilydale. And I don't know if you want to get into that right away, or you want to talk about first piece.
I mean, but they're tied together for me, so we can just do them both at the same time. But Lilydale. There's some corner of my brain where I've read about Lilydale or seen a YouTube clip or something, but like it was new to me. I think for most people, probably it's new to them. Like, can you describe Lilydale? Like, I think you touched on it a little bit earlier.
Yeah. So, there was that, maybe you saw that HBO documentary. Like, there's a short HBO documentary called like The Town That Talks to the Dead or something like that. But anyway, Lilydale, is located in upstate New York, maybe an hour south of Buffalo, and it's home to 275 psychics and mediums. It's this gated community, and usually they don't open their gates to tourists, but in the summertime they do, and usually something like 22,000 people come for all manner of New Age errands. There's seances, astrology walks. There's a healing temple, there's automatic drawing classes, psychic readings, you know, trance channeling, apportations. Apportations are when a medium will produce physical phenomenon out of their body that supposedly comes from the spirit world during a seance.
Like what? We
took an 8-hour workshop with this spiritualist named Reverend Michael Shane. And during the course of that, we did a brief seance in which he produced, I would say, like maybe a pound of stones and rubies and like these stones that came out of his mouth. And we had been with him all night, and he had like duct taped his mouth, and we performed the seance, and he opened it, and you know, right? Like, this is... I mean, some of it you can't help but like regard this as just like sleights of hand, you know, that this is a magic trick. But there are other apportationists who produce, I'm trying to remember the name of, it's like, this like weird effluvia. I don't know. They have this term for it, but it's,
ectoplasm.
Yeah, I'd say it's ectoplasm. It's exactly right. Yeah, I should have been calling upon like the Ghostbuster terminology, but yeah, that's exactly right. Out of their mouths, and there's you can watch what I presume to be heavily edited videos of this online. But yeah, so we went to Lilydale because Andy had started having an increasing number of psychic phenomena, or and it was becoming disturbing to both him and his wife. And he asked me if I wanted to go. And as a kind of writer, I'll confess to a kind of vampiric first impulse. I was like, oh yeah, I'll totally go with you. Right, this will be amazing. And during the course of that experience, we had never been on a road trip together. You know, this is a person, our entire kind of fraternal relationship was forged at a few family gatherings each year, you know, and didn't much talk aside from that. So the trip was almost a rekindling of that relationship, but also, certain things happened that made me suspend my disbelief a little bit in terms of whether or not he was accessing some other kind of knowledge, in part because he was intuiting, suicidal ideation in my part, right? Things that I hadn't disclosed to anyone, not even my wife. He had sensed those things. Yeah.
And he said something to you.
He did. Yeah. During the course of this 8-hour workshop, he did this thing called billet readings. And billet readings, so there were maybe like 10 other people in this class, and the medium, Reverend Michael Shane, asks each person to come up to the front of the room and put silver dollars over your eyes, and then just real out there stuff, right? Duct tape the silver dollars over your eyes, and then wear a bandana. And everyone in the room would write a number on one side of the card, and on the other side of the card, they would write a question. And each person that came to the front of the room and was blindfolded had to take the index cards and just hold them up and try to divine what was on each side of the card, right? And so people were, you know, not even close. I mean, these are people who profess to be mediumistic or profess to be psychics, and maybe we're getting like one number right out of 16 things. And Andy got, and remember, like, I am the least likely person to buy this shit. He got maybe 70% of them right. I have it on audio recording and video. And in the wake of that experience, it was nearing midnight. We walked outside and I asked him about, he had called my mom maybe a year before we went to Lilydale late at night, desperately concerned about me. And my mom's like, what are you talking about? Barrett's fine, blah, 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 blah. And he's like, Andy's like, just go call him, just call him. Let me know what he says. So she calls me, leaves this message. And in the morning I give her a call back and she said, yeah, Andy's really worried about you. And I'm like, oh yeah, I'm fine. I'm fine. And around that time I was in the worst headspace imaginable. And so when we were at Lilydale, I asked him, I was like, do you remember why you called mom that night a year ago? And he's like, yeah. And I said, well, why? And he said, because I saw visions of you killing yourself. And I mean, I didn't include it in the piece, but I, you know, like, I sobbed inappropriately. You know, I mean, that had been something I didn't told anybody about, hadn't told my wife about. I walked out of that experience thinking something else was going on. Some other level of intuition was possible, I guess. I don't believe in spirits or things like that, or any of the kind of new agey theology, right? But, you know, one of the things I do talk about in the piece is this notion of quantum entanglement, that certain people can be quantumly entangled, and there's some fringe physicists who've taken up this idea. And
what does that mean, quantum? Like, just like somehow, like, you know, your brother's in California or Texas or whatever, and you're in Wisconsin, and somehow you're linked up and experiencing each other.
Yeah, essentially. And there's a book by this woman named Dr. Diane Hennessy Powell, who I can't remember if she went to Johns Hopkins, she teaches at Johns Hopkins, but she's studying the ways in which brain trauma, traumatic brain injuries, can increase psychic phenomena, and kind of put people in touch with this kind of quantum knowledge or whatever. All of it feels relatively harebrained to me still, but my skepticism, that sort of hidebound skepticism with which I started the book, you know, tutored in these kind of critical lenses of grad school, had so defrosted by that point that I was willing to at least read about these things, you know, and take them up as possibilities. This idea of quantum. There's an interesting story about Mark Twain and his brother being quantumly entangled. That Twain somehow had a premonition. His brother died, I believe, working in the steam engine of a ship or something, and Twain kind of had premonitions of this beforehand, had a vision of his brother wearing his suit in a casket, and 2 weeks later his brother was dead wearing his suit that he had borrowed from Twain. So yeah, it's kind of out there stuff.
But like, here's the thing. I'm totally willing to go along for the ride on that kind of thing.
Are you?
Yeah. And I like, not because I feel like super definitive in terms of how I see it, but simply because there's so much I don't know, and I'm like professionally wrong. Like, and the human species is, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's in its infancy.
Yeah.
So like, who's to say that there aren't levels of consciousness, or there aren't people out there who have, you know, brain activity that essentially gives them access to layers of consciousness that, you know, the more ordinary folk don't have.
Right.
And I think too, again, I'm going to tie this back into like Buddhist reading that I do, but there was this, actually, I think he was a Hindu like teacher. His name was Neem Karoli Baba. Have you ever heard of this guy?
No.
Well, he was in India, and like a lot of the first wave of baby boomer hippies who went to India and then came back to the States and started the New Age movement, or, you know, as we know it.
Right.
A lot of them were taught by him or influenced by him. And most famously, Ram Dass, the Bay Area, I mean, Harvard, and Timothy Leary, and then Bay Area counterculture guru who wrote Be Here Now. But, you know, Neem Karoli Baba was his guy. And then there were all these other people kind of in Ram Dass's orbit who met him, and they all said the same thing. They all tell stories of, like, you know, you're hanging out, you go up and you go to meet him. Some people just like break down in his presence and start crying and like touching his feet. Which that's where I'm like, okay, A, what? B, that's gross. But then the second thing, and the thing that's more persuasive to me, particularly because there are so many accounts, is that he would just look at you and he would just kind of be like, so your mom died, huh?
Yeah.
This is what he did to Ram Dass. Like, Ram Dass was like this, you know, materialist Harvard professor.
Yeah.
You know, and his mother had died of a spleen injury. And the night before he met, you know, Neem Karoli Baba, he had been, you know, he had woken up in the night to pee, basically. He went outside and then he was looking up at the stars and he thought of his mom who had died like 6 months earlier.
Oh.
And, you know, he wasn't with anybody. This is how he tells it. He just like thought of her and had like a moment of like communion with her and her memory. And then he goes back to bed. And then the next day he meets Neem Karoli Baba and he's like, you were thinking about your mom last night, weren't you? And he's like,
God.
Yeah, he's like, you know, she died. It was something to do with her spleen. And like, so Richard Alpert, you know, this is pre-Ram Dass. Richard Alpert just explodes in tears, sobs. And there are many of these stories where the person's there, named Crowley Baba, tells them basically who they are, looks like right through them, tells them what they're thinking, and their immediate response is to just break down and sob.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, okay, how many of these fucking stories can exist? Like,
right.
I'm willing to be like super skeptical on one, but like over and over again.
Yeah.
And then the other part of me, like the ego, you know, egoistic part of me is like, why the fuck does this shit never happen to me? Like, I want someone to see into my soul. Like, tell me what's going on. Love me, like, unconditionally.
Right.
I'd give anything for this sort of magical experience. Like, why does this never happen to me? But I don't know. Like, I guess I'm just willing. And then I think, too, like, at the level of humility, I'm willing to be open to it. And then I think, too, like, psychedelic experiences have really colored my thinking on a lot of this stuff just because they're so wild and they just obliterate any notion of conventional materialistic reality that I've had to the level that it just leaves me with a very undefined feeling, like 99% of the time. But the 1% that feels really solid and true to me is that, like, there's way more than meets the eye.
Yeah.
Like, whatever I think this is, you know... No,
it's a nice simulation.
It's a workable
simulation. Yeah.
So I don't know. Like, I found the Lilydale chat, you know, essay and the story of your brother. I found all that super riveting.
Oh,
and
okay.
I guess like a question for me or a question for you would be, you know, as he's progressed into his life and away from the injury, have his psychic experiences diminished as his brain has maybe further healed itself, or have they escalated? Like, where does that stuff stand now?
They've escalated. I mean, I think they were escalating and becoming worrisome in the lead up to our trip, because he was seeing things he didn't understand, or he was purporting to see things he didn't understand and that were causing him distress. And some of those things obviously were about me. But in the wake, I think that, you know, as much as that piece ends up being about, you know, coming to terms with my own stuff, I think that that experience for us, and hopefully the essay speaks to it a little bit. I mean, it was really, provided some sort of acceptance for him that he was willing to acknowledge. He wasn't trying to fight these things anymore, but yeah, he does readings for friends all the time. He's still experiencing psychic phenomena. He doesn't seem as haunted by them anymore, or he doesn't seem as unsettled when I ask about it. And it's weird too, because in the wake of that trip, we've kind of returned to our kind of jocular teasing about it, you know. Even despite the kind of seismic emotional revelation of that trip, it's we kind of come at it sidelong still. There's not a lot of discussion about it.
Well, it's intense. And another thing, because I had a psychic, I've had two psychic readings in my life by the same woman. I had one the day before I left for college, and then I had one in my late 20s. So I talked to her twice in a decade, essentially.
Wow.
And she knew shit that she could not possibly have known.
Seriously.
She also told me John Kerry was going to beat George W. Bush. So... Like, I guess the question that I have for you, and I don't know if you've talked this over with your brother, but, you know, you said he got 70% of these things right when he was like, what do you call it when you're trying to read the cards?
It's called billet readings.
Billet readings. So the billet readings, you know, he was 7 out of 10 is a great batting average.
Yeah.
But, like, how does he account for the 3 out of 10 that he misses? And I think, like, you know, I guess unless you're Neem Karoli Baba, maybe he missed some too, but the psychic that I talked to knew things she could not possibly have known. Like, there's just no explanation for it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, got things wrong. And I think she even copped to it when she was talking to me. She's like, I won't get everything right. I won't always get timelines right, you know, when things are going to happen. She predicted my kids, like, with an eerie specificity.
Whoa.
She predicted my wife, like, down to the color of her hair, the way that it looks in the sunlight. Like, shit like that, you know, that you just can't. I can't make sense of it. But what about the stuff you get wrong? You know, like, that's what I wonder about.
Yeah. I mean, I guess Andy's 30% was like his Kerry, John Kerry flub. I don't know. I mean, he talks about it like you know, he uses like electrical metaphors, like a transmission or something, or like the energies. He feels it like a kind of energy. That's how he describes it. But it's weird too. We went and did a psychic reading while we were at Lilydale. We did any number of them, but we went to this woman named, I think it was Gretchen Clark. And she was like a fifth generation spiritualist. So she had five generations of people who had been at Lilydale, at this community. And so it was in her family. And she looked at me within maybe 5 minutes of my sitting on her couch. And she's like, someone's here and they're drowning. And yeah. And I have that essay in the book about my friend Luke who drowned in the Mississippi River. And to
whom this book is dedicated.
Yes. And Andy looks at me with like throttle popped eyes and he's like, that's Luke. Luke's here. And so yeah, I mean, I'm totally willing, like you, I'm willing to believe that people have access to other echelons of consciousness or echelons of energy. I'm comfortable saying I don't know how to even talk about that in a meaningful way. Like the closest approximation was just that Lilydale piece was like trying to get at like, how could I possibly explain this? And it kind of ends in a weird way too. That piece does. Yeah.
How does remind me how it ends?
It ends with a memory of a suicide attempt when I was like a kid, when I was like a early adolescent. But it's the memory of that. I'm at the healing temple at Lilydale and experiencing that memory again.
One of the things that comes to mind when you talk about like not being able to explain it is brain neurochemistry. Like if we're going to try to think about this logically, you know, your brother was not having or was not experiencing psychic phenomena prior to his injury.
Right.
An injury that produced 7 brain contusions and no doubt altered his neurochemistry.
Yeah.
So it seems logical to me that whatever electrical charges he's experiencing are a direct result of the changes in his brain makeup, like chemically, maybe structurally, maybe when it, you know, neuroplasticity, brains rewire themselves.
Right.
Like I don't know how they scan brains these days, you know, but you know how sometimes they can scan a brain and they can show you like what part of the brain is activated by certain stimuli.
Right.
Like, I'm just wondering, like, is there an antenna that got it seems like some sort of antenna got activated in your brother's head that was previously dormant.
Yeah.
And that's what people who are psychic have. They have, you know, for whatever reason, they have an antenna that's receiving these signals.
Yeah. I mean, it could well be. I mean, he would talk about having some experiences before his injury, but I do think whatever happened during the injury, it sharpened it or it sort of jostled his brain into a different acuity of this. But I mean, do you read any Oliver Sacks?
No. I mean, it's like one of those things, like it's on my list.
Yeah. He's got this book about the man who mistook his wife for a hat. And in that book, he has his essay about the proprioception, right? Just like the body's ability to understand where it is in space. And this, I believe it had a brain injured person lost their ability, they lost their proprioception. And so how they would move through space was so disoriented. They had no sense of where their body was at any given time. And so what you're describing is like, okay, yeah, maybe like his neurochemistry changed and some antenna was activated. I find that convincing. I mean, there's an extent to which awareness is bound up. Like the body's awareness of itself is directly tied to certain mechanisms in the brain. So who's to say, you know, that couldn't be rewired in some way? Yeah.
So I want to talk about violence. You know, we've already been talking about it with respect to your brother and this sucker punch and his brain injury. But it's a theme in the book that carries over. You know, I think about the essay about 9/11 and football, and that, you know, in particular that post 9/11 era, the immediate, like the year or the months immediately following 9/11, which for anybody who was, you know, sentient and lived through that, you know, it's pretty hard not to have some strong memories. I certainly do.
Yeah.
It's a weird time.
Yeah.
And like, man, was there a lot of foreboding on my part, especially once like the immediate shock of it started to dull a little bit and you started to get into like, you know, the American response. I started to just get creeped out. But, you know, there's that. There's also like the gun safety exercise on campus, like that essay.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you're confronting American violence in a different way. I'm trying to think of if there's anything else like peacefully organic produce, you know, where you go to the farm where the military veteran has essentially, I mean, at least in my read of it, is like questing to build a kind of utopia in the aftermath of like a difficult war experience.
Yeah.
So that's another manifestation of how violence can affect, you know, the heart and the psyche. So I don't know. I guess like, maybe a question would be where it all left you, you know, these explorations. It certainly seems like something you were trying to confront either consciously or not, you know. Do you find yourself with a deeper understanding of what plagues us? Or have you gotten to a place where you feel, I don't know how you could feel at peace about it. That seems like an oxymoron, but you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, where did it lead you, all these different confrontations?
Yeah, I mean, there's a way, I think, yeah, it's interesting. I didn't necessarily think about those three pieces being in conversation with one another, but I definitely think they are in some sense. And two, I would probably loop in the Disaster City piece because it's a kind of violence. Yeah, I mean, the sort of personal element to this is that, you know, I was like a cataleptically fearful little kid and had obsessive compulsive disorder. And the ways in which my obsessive compulsive disorder has this element called intrusive thought syndrome, which is basically the person gets bombarded with what the literature calls ego dystonic thoughts, thoughts that don't seem in keeping with who you are as a person or what your ordinary life looks like. And so, you know, you'd be haunted by visions of just like coming home from school and your like family members are strung up on the rafters of your garage or something like that. Or you go to school and you see tornadoes like just eviscerating everyone. So the constant bombardment of these sorts of thoughts. So I think that at least going to Disaster City, that was an essay in which it was like a topic that, like so many of the pieces when they're first assigned to me, they're just kind of like these zany topics. Like, oh yeah, there's a 52-acre compound in College Station, Texas, where FEMA trains their first responders by coming up with the simulated town where they do train derailments, collapsed buildings, mass shootings, pandemics, any possible woe you can think of. And they hire victim volunteers and they embed them in all these scenarios and put makeup on them and, you know, metal impalements sticking out of them. It's almost like Hollywood grade moulage. And so I go there thinking that this is just going to be a kind of funny, fun piece, right? But what actually, you know, in doing some of the prefatory research, what you learn is that this is part of a national response to these types of situations that privileges preparedness over prevention. Like actually trying to prevent these things from happening would require some other kind of narrative about how we might redress these things. And so I'm like I guess a evocative example of this that emerged from the research was that, you know, in the 1970s, I think it's the early 1970s that FEMA got started, all of the sort of disaster appropriations for disaster preparedness that Congress gave out were really geared toward Cold War narratives, right? Like staving off a nuclear attack from Russia or something like that. When the far more costly, both in terms of financial, like, you know, damage, infrastructure damage, lives being lost, the more urgent and exigent disasters were hurricanes, bad zoning laws, building in hazardous landscapes. And unsurprisingly, that tracks pretty neatly across class lines, where, you know, poor communities of color were most grievously affected by these bad real estate decisions and these criminally negligent zoning laws. And so that kind of narrative about what are our true priorities in terms of preparedness, it actually can cause harm, can cause violence, systemic violence. And so when I was at Disaster City and taking part in this thing, and I'm sitting in rubble, I'm realizing that I'm kind of enacting, or I'm being enlisted or conscripted in this case, into a kind of narrative about, oh yes, FEMA and first responders, like, these people are doing unquestionably laudable work, but they are too part of a kind of national narrative about how we're supposed to respond to disaster. Like, we've built disaster into the design, as it were, right? Like, this is part of it. We have whole mechanisms in the culture that take for granted that these sorts of this damage from hurricanes, et cetera, is going to happen, instead of maybe marshaling the political will to reimagine how we think about zoning laws, or how we think about construction, or what we're going to decide as a country is the best way to legislate building regulations or these sorts of things.
And so, like, just to interrupt, like, but not to get too dark and cynical about it, but that I also immediately start thinking about disaster capitalism. I don't know. Is that Naomi Klein?
Naomi Klein.
I'm always like, okay, so instead of, like you say, making efforts to prepare so that these sorts of things don't happen at all, or like we can mitigate against it, I'm also thinking, well, who's going to profit from it if we don't?
Right. Precisely. Right. And so it's, if there was a unifying sort of intellectual project across these essays, I think it was kind of peeling back the onion layers, or to mix metaphors, pulling back the curtain on some of these narratives and how they're actually perpetuating some of the systemic issues that they claim to solve, right? Like, the other salient example that's coming to mind is the piece about the Venus Project. The Venus Project was this utopian community developed by a self-proclaimed social engineer named Jacques Fresco, who wanted, he's since passed away, he was 99 years old at the time that I visited the Venus Project. He wanted to replace capitalism with a resource-based economy that would be run by technology and free human beings to, I don't know, philosophize in, the garden or whatever, right? So all sounded pretty dreamy and something like I could get down with. I found out about him from a student of mine who wrote a paper about him, and found this YouTube clip of Fresco talking at an Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Miami rally in 2011. And he was speaking with sort of, a revolutionary's elan about how protesting the stock market isn't going to do anything. You need to fundamentally reimagine the culture, which I found kind of quixotically, kind of delicious, and regarded him with some skepticism. But of course, so this sort of techno-utopian idea, right? I go down there and, get the tour of this, I believe it's a 22-acre compound of these, like, he's got these domes that look like portobello mushroom caps, right? And they're supposed to be like an Epcot-like design of the future. And really, it was these antiquated, it was like a vision of like Soviet futurism from the 1970s or something. It was so bizarre, right? And he was like, here is the future. I'm walking around and I noticed this guy's got a Facebook backpack on. And I started talking to him, and sure enough, he works at Facebook. And he's like, you know, it's funny because Facebook's doing a lot of the things that Jacques Fresco is talking about. And it was revealing to me it was evocative of the ways in which so many aspects of, you know, our tech overlords kind of appropriate the language of utopianism. They paint everything with the patina of almost like communitarian jargon, right? And so the things that were coming in under the banner of progressivism, this kind of like techno-utopian element, when in practice right now we're seeing the after effects of that kind of those efforts, right? We're seeing epistemological confusion like never before. We're seeing the perpetuation of gross inequities, you know, in the tech world.
The complete decimation of any shared sense of civic identity, in the manner of a decade, or in the matter of a decade. And you know, along those same lines, I was having this conversation with a friend of mine the other day around universal basic income, which is kind of like, you know, it's often bandied about in progressive circles, and I think it's especially popular maybe in like the tech world as like a solution.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I'm so suspicious of it because all I keep thinking is like, okay, so here's what they're going to do. They're going to have robots and AI that are going to be doing most of the jobs that people have now. They're going to give everybody $2,500 a month, which, you know, adjusted for inflation is dog shit, you know.
Like
it's dog shit now, and it could be even more dog shit 20 years from now.
Right.
And then the Zuckerbergs and the quote-unquote elites of the world, they're going to have all the money. They're going to have the safe house in New Zealand. They're going to have the lakefront place in Tahoe for, like, their little mini retreats among their buddies. And they're going to be like, what are you complaining about? You've got UBI, bro. You've got UBI. Like, you can philosophize in the garden while I'm on my Learjet. You know,
right? Exactly. Right. Yeah. When you say too, you've got UBI, it doesn't. It sounds, you know, like an STI or something.
Yeah, exactly. It might as well be. I think we should all remember that. So I look very skeptically at anybody who's trying to sell me on universal basic income unless it's exactly half of what Mark Zuckerberg is worth. Then we can talk.
Right.
Well, I want to talk to you about I think it's the last essay in the book. It's kind of like a piece of literary criticism, if I'm recalling it correctly, where you're talking in particular, it's not just about Sheila Hedy's book, How Should a Person Be, but that's one of the centerpieces of it.
Yeah.
And I love that book, first of all.
I do too.
Yeah, I just have so much admiration for Sheila. I've had her on the show, and I think that book is just great. And I don't know if I've ever had somebody explain to me quite why I like it so much, as well as you did in this essay. So I want to thank you for that. I was like, oh
thanks.
No wonder that one stuck to me. But the phrase that I want to get to is the post-religious quest.
Yeah.
I guess that sort of stuff always speaks to me. It's kind of like something I'm fixated on as a person, but I never saw it in those terms necessarily. And I think there's a lot of truth in that characterization of it, you know, that the Sheila writer person and the Sheila character in the book, you know, are trying to make sense of the world post-religion, which I think you are too. And I am too, at least to some extent. I mean, you know, like, I think that's the appeal of Buddhism to me, is that it's not, there's not any, magical thinking in it, you know,
right.
At least at its best. And so, you know, maybe I'm a little bit more structured than most post-religious people, but I'm certainly post the Catholicism of my youth, you know?
Right.
So I don't know, I guess, like, maybe just talk a little bit about that book and how it affected you, and maybe get into the weeds a little bit more on post-religious quest.
Yeah, I mean, what you're describing is a sort of like the eschewal of the like Catholicism of your youth. I mean, there's a certain extent to which I feel like, you know, that dilemma, right? Like being in this kind of post-religious moment is roughly commensurate with where the 21st century thought brought us, like the post-Nietzschean, like death of God, you know, the post-Vietnam death of like any sort of trust in your government, like those reigning points of orientation where we might have otherwise placed some sense of identity or association, they've really fallen by the wayside, right? We're not going to, I'm at least, as we moderns aren't going to, you know, associate earnestly or go all the way with maybe a traditional religion or a traditional sense of country or anything like that. And it struck me as kind of like, I mean, I don't think it's unique necessarily to this moment, but I do think that kind of post 9/11, post 2008 recession, that becoming an adult at that moment was a pretty weird headspace to occupy. And so I couldn't help but noticing the essay to which you're referring is called Church Not Made with Hands. And it's about this kind of cluster of books that I saw somehow related. So there's Sheila Hetty's book, which, I mean, I think she's a true genius. I'm like desperate to see what she does next. I thought the next book that she did, Motherhood, was the most interesting and exciting novel that I've read, you know, in a while. So I talk about that book. I talk about Carl Ove Nosgaard. And then I talk about the work of Flannery O'Connor and a little bit about David Foster Wallace, Ben Lerner, Talwin, those writers. But really what I see as kind of the post-religious quest, or what I saw the Sheila character in that book doing, is really casting about for like ways of living, ways of being in the world. And I believe it's the character's name is Margot, the friend, who she uses as a kind of model for being. And weirdly, you know, in the wake of having written that essay, I've been reading a lot of Stanley Cavell. Have you read Stanley Cavell at all?
No.
He's got this insufficiently celebrated book called The Senses of Walden, and it's about Henry David Thoreau's Walden, which is a book that never really, you know, like, this is like, you know, starchy curriculum reading that you get in high school, at least I did, right? And I the transcendentalist or whatever, but Cavell, really,
I gotta say, I'm a total like transcendentalist stan. I love him.
Yeah, no, I mean, by now I think I'm with you. Having read The Senses of Wildness, Cavell's got this notion of perfectionism. And it's basically this philosophy, and this is like a radical simplification of the philosophy, but that basically moments in which you're kind of standing outside yourself, having ecstatic experiences, you become your own neighbor, and he reads Thoreau as saying that like we can look at the world and look at each other as moral examples that are fonts of kind of moral lessons about how we might conduct ourselves. And you know, there's so much in Thoreau and Walden about measuring and like plumbing the depths of the farm and like figuring out its fathoms or bean counting. There's all these like units of measurement. And for Cavell, this is supposed to be mimetic of kind of the moral practice by which we regard the world and other people as instantiations of how we might live and how we should measure ourselves against them. And so for me, you know, I think Sheila Hetty is dealing with Kierkegaard's Either Or, another book that, you know, I would, you know, clutch if there was a fire in my apartment. But I think that relationship between her and Margot is a form of Cavell's perfectionism, right? Like really looking at the people in your immediate life as models, taking them seriously as models for how to live, and almost studying them, one's friends and family as sources of wisdom. That sounds tremendously maybe saccharine, but I've come to believe it. At the end of that essay, Church Not Made with Hands, I talk about how marriage for me has offered this kind of way of doing that, right? Marriage is a kind of narrative in which you become enchanted, right? It depends upon you and your partner, your spouse, believing in the relationship. That's, it kind of hinges upon that. So it is this kind of story or this enchantment, but what a marriage is, and there's no way in which I'm saying that this is the only way by which you can have this kind of perspectival change about how you might look at the other people in your life. But it really is, the wedding for me was like a public renunciation of self. It was an announcement that I was going to take up a perspective that's going to be shared always, right? And that's daily spade work. I mean, that is something that you have to work at every single day. And Cavell has this other amazing book called that I just read like 2 weeks ago. I've been into the pandemic. My pandemic viewing has been the screwball comedies of the 1930s and 40s. Have you seen these, like The Awful Truth or His Girl Friday, like Cary Grant, right? Catherine Hepburn, Irene Dunne. And these, Cavell calls them comedies of remarriage, right? These, the beginning of the movies, and they're based off like Shakespeare's late plays, like The Winter's Tale or something like that, right? The beginning of the movie, the couple is in disarray. There's the threat of the divorce, or actively they do get separated. And by the end of the movie, they somehow come back together. So whatever, and it's usually some sort of madcap, hilarious plot that somehow gets them to resuscitate their bond. But Cavell, in this book, Pursuits of Happiness, he's talking about the kind of the calisthenics of mind that are required to become remarried again, to learn to forgive, to learn to have the imaginative space to see one's partner as a stranger again, to kind of be able to fall in love with them again. And he makes this radically provocative point. He says that the sort of gestures that are required by marriage are the same ones that are required by living within a republic or living within a democracy, which I don't know if I believe. But it's such a daring statement, and so anathema to the sort of perspectival habits that we have right now that I can't help but find it compelling. You know, like, that being part of a community requires a kind of imaginative labor, and it's just not something that we're tutored in,
I don't want to say this before I forget, is that like two words come to mind as I think about everything that you're saying. I haven't read Cavell, but you know, I get where you're working, like thematically.
Yeah.
But Sheila Hedy, Ben Lerner, Tao Lin, David Foster Wallace, Henry David Thoreau.
Yeah.
Two words come to mind, like radical and attention.
Yeah.
And so you talk about like casting about for ways to live, or looking to your friends and family in your immediate sphere as models for how to live. You know, I think what makes, or a big part of what makes How Should a Person Be So Compelling, and how I think any book is compelling, is the quality of the author's attention.
Mm.
And there is a kind of maximalism, I think, in Tao Lin especially. Like, man, like, talk about like maximal, slow, attentive,
yeah,
concentration on every last detail,
yeah,
of existence. Ben Lerner, I think, does a great job of that. He's especially good, I think, at like paying attention to the psyche. Like, you know, it's been a while since I've read him, but like, man, I just feel like he really pays attention to his own mind, you know, the machinations,
yeah,
of his own mind and thought. And yeah, Henry David Thoreau, like radical attention in particular to the physical world, like,
yeah,
bean counting, like going for a 4-hour walk every day, staring at a leaf for like 6 hours or whatever,
yeah,
he would do.
Yeah.
And there's something, and then you talk about marriage, or you talk about human relationship generally, whether it's in the context of a friendship or in the context of a community or as a citizen of a,
yeah,
city, a county, a state, a country. You can't love someone without being attentive to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like the quality of your attention is directly related to the quality of your caring and love, whether it's in,
yeah,
an intimate relationship or a friendship or a neighborly way, or,
yeah,
just like talking to somebody in the street, you know, giving them your full attention.
Yeah.
There's something really radical about it. And there's something I can't help but feel, too, that it cuts against the attention economy that yeah. we're all lost in right now with our phones and these fucking social media apps. Like, you know, yeah. how many times have you been talking to somebody and they're just like diving into their phone while they're talking to you? And like,
yeah,
it's a crusher. And I do it
yeah,
too.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly. You know, and too, I teach school. I teach at a university, and I notice that in my students, this sort of deprivation of attention and a kind of great sadness about how they're being instructed on how to be a person, right? They're told to cultivate followings and see, you know, I think even the university is sort of trying to professionalize them before they treat them as humans. And I have students coming to my office hours routinely with a kind of desperation in their voice, just like really lost about what they should be doing and where they should be placing meaning in their lives. And I don't think that that's unrelated to the attention economy at all, and the ways in which they're asked to participate socially all day, essentially.
I feel the stress of this. Like, I've disconnected from it, like social media wise, but it's with the understanding that it's in some ways to my own detriment. Like, the way things are set up now, if you don't have that quote unquote platform, if you don't have that audience, it's pretty hard to make headway otherwise.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that I often think about is the ways in which social media in particular seems to incentivize people to take on like a victim identity. And it's a little dicey to talk about because there is such a thing as genuine victimhood, and I don't mean to diminish that. But I think that if you're thinking about like a young college student or anybody who's looking out at the landscape and trying to figure out a way to make it in the world creatively for the purposes of this conversation, like, it sure does seem like if you've got like a grievance to air, that's a way to get reciprocity on social media. You know, if something has happened to you, and you can make hay of that on social media, it's a way to get lots of likes and retweets and attention. And sometimes that's good. Sometimes it's good to air a grievance. You know, I don't want to misstep, but I can't help but feel like there is an incentive structure that has been built in these environments that isn't necessarily always healthy.
Well, I mean, social media for me is just the, it's, I avoid it. My wife makes fun of me. She says I'm like the Greg Kinnear character from You've Got Mail, who, I don't know if you remember this movie, but he's like railing against big box stores and was worried that like the ebook would threaten, you know, traditional publishing, to which I often retort, well, he was right. You know, he was right a little bit about that. I mean, I'm wary of social media just at, like, on a personal level. Like, I think, you know, like, I just constitutionally, it's nice to be liked and to like feel validated. And I worry that, I would, you know, if I was on there, I would just grow obsessed with it. And, so I avoid it. And, I don't know. I think I'm marginally healthier as a result of it, just not being on there. But it's weird as a writer, though, right? Because it, as you were saying, like, it's nice to have that platform. It's important to have that platform. But I think I know where my head can go, so I avoid things that will take me down those corridors, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, I like to, you know, talk about how I've disconnected from it. Part of the reason I had to disconnect from it is because I was more affected by it and more addicted to it than the average person. So, like,
right,
you know, like, that's an important point to make. And I just couldn't handle it. I guess there are people who can handle it, but I guess where I bristle is at this, you know, at this feeling of like, well, it's almost like an obligation, or there's a penalty for not participating. That's like very real, you know?
Did you start meditating after you left social media?
No, I mean, I've been doing that since I was like, you know, late college. It got more serious, like as I grew up and had kids and stuff, like the practice has become more sophisticated and, you know, everything else, but it started young. I think that the decision to leave social media was tied to reading that I did. I think once I started to read deeply, more deeply about it and like thought about like the consequences of it, I was just sold by that. But the kind of reading that I was doing spoke as well to meditating.
Yeah.
You know, just as like a ritualized activity that, you know, helps me pay attention better.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess like, I just realized that probably in the aggregate wasn't good for me.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, it was coming at it from the sort of like surveillance capitalism angle.
Yeah.
But kind of coming out of it, like having avoided social media or deciding not to do it, I feel like maybe the sort of attentive element is becoming more apparent to me.
Have you read that book, Surveillance Capitalism?
The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. Yeah. I teach parts of it. Yeah, it's an incredible book. I mean, I don't know why that book should be winning all the prizes or have won all the prizes. But
I made the same argument. I'm like, this feels like something. I can't believe everybody's not.
Oh
like,
yeah,
pounding the table it's over like this book, because once you realize, like, oh wait, like, data is the new oil, and these companies are like they're tracking every move I make and then selling that in you know intel.
Yeah.
You know, every which way, like with consequences that we can't even really fathom, you know, like who knows exactly how it's all going to be used in the end, but like, it's terrifying. And
well, too, I mean, it's weird to think about it at the level of design, right? The sort of the ways in which it's designed to harvest certain information from us, and it creates a definition of personhood to which we comply in some sense, just by virtue of using the platforms. Right. And so there's a sort of embedded, like Jaron Lanier talks about this in his book, You Are Not a Gadget, where the software itself has this embedded definition of personhood, which runs, at least from my vantage, it's wholly antithetical to the sort of definitions of personhood that the books I trust kind of train me in. And so it feels like there's this cognitive dissonance between the definition of personhood that we're asked to inhabit when we engage in the market or when we go online, and then that which we might be nourished by in other realms, or the kind of perspectival habits we might otherwise be trained in order to be part of a community, kind of like what we were talking about earlier. Yeah.
Well, I had a conversation on this program. I've had a couple of conversations with a writer named Jarrett Kobeck. He wrote a book called I Hate the Internet. which became kind of like a cult hit, you know, unexpectedly to him, it, you know, just kind of like took off. I think the title alone, everyone was like, yes, let me read that.
Yeah. You know?
But he's really smart on this stuff and thinks a lot about it. And I remember, if I'm recalling correctly, that we were talking and he was talking about the gendered nature of platforms like Facebook and Twitter and, you know, you name it. But these things were created almost exclusively by dudes. And you know, like it's worth thinking about that, because like you say, they have a profound influence on the ways in which we conceive of personhood. And they were all, you know, created by incels. Essentially. Like, I mean, you know,
well, I mean, yeah, I mean, like the what Facebook was that was created by a Harvard sophomore whose early, like the beta stage was what, like essentially hot or not, right? Like
that's
just
right.
Like the that's misogyny is built into the sort of founding premise of that. It's just terribly sad.
So last thing I want to talk to you about is you, because you are a through line. Obviously, in the collection, you're kind of the protagonist, you know, traveling about in all these essays and you know, observing. And I think as a character, what I find compelling about you is the fact that you're so erudite. There's something anachronistic about your prose style, or like a bit, you know, there's something a little bit old world about your presentation on the page. And yet it's all very contemporary, you know, in its explorations. And then, you know, like you've been talking about, you know, there's a depressive, you know, like emotional struggle that you've had to deal with in your adult years, which I think is a proportionate response to human reality. but then also you come from this family of like super athletic dudes. You know, your dad played basketball at Marquette for Al McGuire, mm-hmm. who I mm-hmm. was just talking about yesterday because, you know, we really? Both grew up in suburban Milwaukee. We share that in common. I continue to be a Brewers and a Packers fan because my my sports allegiances were forged in early youth and like they're unbreakable.
Yeah.
So like I have not missed a game in an embarrassing number of years. And
yeah.
I just find it interesting that this is all part of the package with you, that you were the quarterback of your high school football team and yet you're struggling with OCD and suicidal ideation and depression and I mean, I don't know. I guess that's, of course those things can come in the same package, but it's just, I guess it plays interestingly on the page as a character, you know, if I can reduce it to that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, what to say about that? I mean, the variety of subcultures I visit, we'll say, or embed in or immerse myself in, I think it corresponds to like how many, like this wardrobe of self, right? Like, I don't know if you experienced this, but like I've tried different things, a lot of different things, a lot of different ways of being. And, for me, writer, it's really crucial for me. Like, into these places, there's a danger, I think, in being touristic, you know, looking at the subculture and kind of pointing and sneering, or just kind of, you know, being the egghead that like looks at the culture and says something erudite or fanciful, right? But for me, I don't go to a place unless I kind of know why I don't write about the place unless I know why it's why I'm going, why Barrett the writer is going, and why I'm emotionally connected to the place. And I'm trying, however successfully or unsuccessfully, I'm trying to kind of triangulate myself with the subject and the reader. Like if I can put myself up for scrutiny next to the subjects of my pieces and say, here, reader, look at both of us together at the same time. And I'm making myself available next to the subject for just as much scrutiny and analysis. Then I think, I hope that a kind of connection is forged between the three of us, however fleetingly, right? And so that kind of impulse, I think, requires me to kind of go into my life and think about the various headspaces or different, you know, linguists would call them discourse communities. Like thinking about like the football essay, right? Like, yeah, I played football in high school. But for me, what was interesting about that experience, or what remains interesting about that experience, has very little to do with any sort of like triumphant, like highlight reel of like my best plays or whatever. But what remains indelible to me is the ways in which that activity and the habits of mind about, and this is going to sound whatever, throwing a pass, leading a receiver into open field becomes an embodiment or an incarnation of the habits of mind that when you think empathetically, right? When you anticipate where someone's going to be, that you're there with them. And the language around sport, particularly football, is so militaristic and so violence laden that it just seemed so incompatible with some of the beauty of the game that I myself partook in. And there was a kind of sadness to playing quarterback because you were the one person on the field that saw that, who is embodying it. And so when I make myself vulnerable by talking about some of these experiences. It's only in service of trying to articulate a habit of mind that I'm trying to cultivate in myself and trying to be able to express. I mean, if you backed me into a corner, I would probably say that all of the pieces kind of make they're different iterations of that same conceptual practice, right? That I'm, if it's the intellectual swerve is the kind of like, how is this narrative actually perpetuating some sort of systemic thing that I find problematic or just kind of insufficient? The personal thing is, all right, how is that narrative affecting me so that I'm like no longer paying attention to what's around me? It sort of relinquishes or releases me from the responsibility of having to think by subscribing to some narrative. I mean, that's what ideology is, right? Ideology is, it's a shortcut. It's not thinking. It is the sort of reflexive way of looking at the world. And an ethic of dutiful attention requires like holding up for suspicion these narratives that we tell ourselves about what does it mean to be a person? Where do I place value in my life? How should I regard people with whom I disagree? How should I think about being an American or being, you know, a millennial or being a citizen at this moment in history? Or being a man, being a white person, all of these things, like how are there are certain cultural narratives built in and how are they affecting me? And so, yeah, that's why I think I kind of am harvesting my own life, is because it's the entry point for me to come by these things honestly.
Well, that's what I'm going to say. It's how you build trust with the reader too, you know?
Yeah.
Like you say, you don't want to be touristic and lopsided, you know? I think you have to have some skin in the game. I think that's how
a
reader knows that you're an honest broker.
And I mean, we're talking about Sheila Hedy, and she's one of those writers that I think does that, right? Like the autofictional impulse, when it's done well, like with someone like Sheila Hedy, I trust that person. Rachel Kadzi Ganza is another one, or Aleph Bautzman. These writers who, or Elisa Gabbert, she just had a book come out last year called The Unreality of Memory. It's like writers who have skin in the game. They're really making themselves present. And it feels, you feel that urgency on the page when you read them.
Yeah, I love that. I don't know. I mean, I think it's all a matter of taste, but like that's right up my alley. When I feel like there's, I always say I like there to be as little membrane as possible between me and the person who's writing. And that can come in a lot of different packages. But when I don't feel that person close to the writing, then I'm just like, it's hard for me to access it, you know?
Yeah.
I think too, and I mean, this is kind of a curveball. But it came to me as you were talking about your approach and how you're, you know, embedding yourself in all these different worlds and assessing the situation that we're in as people right now, and maybe Americans in particular. I have increasingly been having the feeling, and I shared this, I think, with Melissa Phoebos. It might be the first time I've ever talked about it on this show, which now means I'm going to talk about it every episode for like the next 3 years, you know, this is because I get fixed on these ideas. But I have hunches that coalesce in me, you know, as the result of all a variety of different inputs, you know, and I cannot help but feel like we are heading towards a time as human beings where there are going to be more and more radical, intentional communities formed in environments that maybe cut against traditional expectations of such things. So yes, there might be like, you know, intentional communities formed out in the boonies where people are living communally on a farm. And I know these things have existed for a long time. You know, I know there have been urban intentional communities that exist and have existed. But I just think that climate and political reality, those two things are tightly bound in my mind, are going to force our hand.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be enough for like one person to cut the cord. It's going to have to happen in community, not only because it might be the only way for these sorts of things to be survivable or livable, but also yeah. because the power of communities who exemplify different modes of being will be that much greater than they would be if it was just like one person, like Henry David Thoreau, mm-hmm. like looking at a leaf at Walden Pond,
right.
you know,
right.
You know, I guess if they write a great classic book, then maybe they can reach a lot of people, but, it's like a way of saying like, this is where I see things headed in the future. It's also a way of saying that, like, I think there's a lot of things in our past that we haven't properly mined or that we've forgotten.
Yeah. Yeah,
I think that there are radical, like, I think a lot of the answers are already here, I guess. Some of them are going to have to be adapted to the realities of life on planet Earth once we are at 1.5 degrees, global temperature rise or whatever. But
right.
I think we kind of have to go backwards and forwards at the same time, if that is a tolerable way to put it.
Yeah. No, I'm thinking of that Rebecca Solnit book in which she talks about like communities forged in hellish, in the wake of hellish disasters. And I think you're right. I mean, I think that disaster is a fertile terrain for new ways of approaching what it is we're doing here and how we're going to get along.
It's also fertile terrain for making a shitload of money on condominiums.
Yes. Yes. that is inarguably true.
Well, Barrett, it's been fun talking with you. Really appreciate the book and all that went into it. And also your candor, you know, I think the ways in which you talk about your personal struggles is, helpful to readers, or it certainly was helpful to me. You know, I'm always like, I always feel a sense of relief when somebody opens up like that. I hope you're doing well, you know, taking care of yourself. It feels like this book was kind of a raft, you know, from one shore to another. But just, you know, hang in there and be well. And I'll be very interested to see what you come up with next. Are you working on another book?
I'm working on a few essays. I got some fiction in the hopper too, so we'll see. We'll see what we'll see like what permutation all this takes. It might be another essay collection. It might be. I've got some stories that are done, and a couple of new ones. So maybe a book of stories. We'll see. But
well, talk to your brother. Talk to your brother and have him tell you what's going to happen.
Have him tell me. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having me on. This was absolutely. A thrill and an honor for me, so I appreciate it.
All right, you guys, that's it. That's Barrett Swanson. That's the conversation. His new essay collection is called Lost in Summerland. It's out there now from Counterpoint Press. You can find him on the internet at barrettswanson.com. He publishes widely in magazines. Barrett Swanson, Lost in Summerland, available now. Go get your copy. Do it right now while I'm talking. Lost in Summerland. The Other People podcast is offered freely. More than 700 episodes and counting. The entire archive is made available to you for free. If you like this show, if you get something from it, if you listen on a regular basis and you have the means, support the show, tip your server. You can do that over at patreon.com/otherpplpod. patreon.com/otherpplpod. There are different levels of support. For as little as $1 a month, you can support this show. At higher tiers, you can get stuff. I'll send you a postcard. You can get a t-shirt. You can get a coffee mug, a tote bag, a sticker. I'll wish you a happy birthday even. patreon.com/otherpplpod. If you would like to write to me, if you have something you want to say, just email me. The address for the show is letters@otherppl.com, letters@otherppl.com. This show also has its own app, The Other People with Brad Listy app. It's free. The Other People app. Go get it. It's free. Why not, right? It's a good app. The Other People podcast is also now available on YouTube. It has its own YouTube channel. Every single episode is up on YouTube. Go get it. Subscribe. Smash the subscribe button, as the kids say. Who's coming up next? I have no idea. That's where I'm at right now, spiritually. But there will be a show. I don't know, man. We're heading into summer. We're lost in
lost in Summerland already. It's not even summer, though, officially. We got to wait till June 21st, but you know what I mean. I hope you're doing okay. I hope you're hanging in there. I hope you're reintegrating into society as COVID restrictions ease a bit. Is social stuff weird? Okay.